Mr. Professor Manfred Mohr is next, and welcome.
Thank you so much. Before I start, or while starting, could some people just give me a hand in distributing some paper? Would be nice. Maybe also some two or three colleagues from the back benches to just put this around. Because this directly links to what Solange has said in the end of the presentation. We have to do something. We have to make headway. We have to get a step forward, and not always getting together in conference like this and saying, "Oh, this is all terrible," and we say it's illegal, and we have to condemn depleted uranium. But now, we, that is YALANA, the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms, and IPPNW, Germany, we did some homework, and you get it now. It's a draft convention, a draft treaty on outlawing depleted uranium ammunition and other military use of depleted uranium. That is just our proposal to this conference, and at a very early stage, a working paper, not yet fit for official quotation, but something to look at. And I know in this room we maybe have different opinions about the usefulness of such a draft treaty process being started, but I very much urge you to have a look at this paper and follow the discussion, because now we have substance, I think, with the draft text, and we can reach out also to other experts, to governmental experts, and maybe try and find some lobbying scheme scenario to go ahead with it politically. This is something for the strategic workshop tomorrow. And I see some opportunities just because the UN process, as Karin Parker explained to us, has stopped in a certain way. We have to continue with some other proposals. And I think a draft treaty is not counterproductive at all. It is quite normal that there may be some weaponry illegal under international humanitarian law being used. On the other hand, you have a treaty confirming this and spelling out the ban of such a weapon. Take the chemical weapons. Chemical weapons are more or less illegal when used. That was clear for decades. It was clear from the 1925 gas protocol already. But now you have the Chemical Weapons Convention to finish this process, to have a chemical weapons institution, to have verification schemes, and then to get the stage where the weapon as such is outlawed, is banned. And that's what we are all striving for, to reach for depleted uranium weaponry as well. So maybe we should have a short look, we rush through this draft text, and then discuss it later on in the strategic workshop.
Whole paper.
No, I just mentioned the articles, yeah. But one or two sentences, that's all. Not to read it out.
Because it's a good paper to discuss at a workshop.
Yes, but just to highlight the main points, mm-hmm. Not to read it out. No man, legal details, don't worry. Just maybe to have it tonight in your hotel room and read it carefully. The preamble, I think it's quite important. The preamble is something legally valid in every treaty. It's not only words, it's already the legal text. And in this preamble, we try to have the link between customary international law, which says DU use is illegal, and this treaty. Because in the preamble, we are quoting all these principles, Karin Parker has mentioned earlier. We are quoting sub-commission resolutions, everything that's there. And so you can just combine these two processes, the legal treaty process and the customary legal process. Then we start with Article 1, the general obligations. And this is the comprehensive prohibition of depleted uranium weaponry being used under whatever circumstances. So this is a very kind of watertight prohibition, very comprehensive, and it says the use is illegal and the weapon has to be destroyed. You got to get rid of this weapon. It should not exist any longer. That's the main message of general article of the general obligations of Article 1. This also extends to pre-products. This also extends to the obligation to transform depleted uranium into a stable chemical compound which is safe. We think it's possible, but that's more for other experts to decide. At least it's an idea. Article 2 is normal. It contains definitions. No problem. Article 3, this is something to still be discussed further. Exceptions. So exceptions concern the transfer of DU ammunition for the sake of destruction. Okay, it may be useful to transport this ammunition or this material to another country where it could be destroyed. The second paragraph is more problematic, matter for discussion. What about civil use? We try to introduce civil use prohibition also into this treaty, which is mainly on military use. But we are not clear whether that may work. What about exception? What about civil use for scientific or medical purposes, as we put it in paragraph 2 of Article 3, something open to be debated. Now, Article 4, I think that's a crucial practical issue, decontamination. What about areas being contaminated by DU use for decades, decades, hundreds of years? That is the main problem also for the Ottawa Treaty, and that we took the Ottawa Treaty as an example here for this obligation to identify, to warn, to decontaminate, and so on. But these are the obligations that exist, which are costly to be implemented. We know that, but anyway, that's a core issue. By the way, the International Committee of the Red Cross has started a discussion process on remnants of war, as they call it. They say explosive remnants of war, but maybe also other remnants of war like DU in the soil, and there maybe we have a possibility to lobby for that draft treaty. Now, Article 5 is on support. As I said, all these measures are time-consuming, they are costly, expensive, and the areas hit, the countries that suffer from DU use, are extremely poor countries like Iraq or the Kosovo area, others just hit by the war, suffering from war consequences. They need support, they need cooperation. That's why we have a long article, Article 5, on this issue. Now, in Article 6, we try to develop a new form of cooperation, calling it partnership. It may be that two countries have close cooperation ties anyway, and they can use it, and they form like couples to help each other in solving these problems. That's partnership, a new idea. Article 7, again, is very normal, natural. You have the international treaty, and this international treaty has to become effective in the domestic settings of a country, of a state. So it needs implementation measures. Everything we have here in Article 7 will be effective in this direction, to have penal law, administrative law in the domestic field to implement the treaty. Now, Article 8, again, is somewhat tricky, maybe. You know the nuclear weapons debate. Most of you, and I think most of you know the construction of security insurances, security guarantees. So if a state is attacked by a nuclear weapon, though prohibited to have nuclear weapons, it may get help from nuclear weapon states. That's the rationale behind. We have that system, and we try to introduce it into the DU topic as well. So if a country is attacked by DU weapons, it may ask for help in a military sense, though still being prohibited using DU weaponry itself. That's, again, maybe something for a discussion, but we have this idea put here. Now, the rest of the treaty is institutional matters, organizational matters. I will not bother you with that and just say what we propose here in Article 19 and following meeting of state parties, review conference, a uranium weapons center, kind of information center. This is quite normal, but it's still not sophisticated, developed institutional system. It's on a very low level. If we take the Chemical Weapon Convention as the model, as the parallel, there you have a huge organization. You have inspection systems. You have hundreds of people working for this scheme. This is less developed. It's a proposal, a first step to have only a few bodies and not so many just detailed rules on this. Article 12, again, is a little bit more important. It's on funds. And the idea behind is to have voluntary funds to give financial help to countries, to people, to persons that suffered from DUs because they themselves are not able to cope with the problem. Now then, the end is peaceful settlement of dispute system, fact-finding mission, Article 15, and then still have a final look maybe at Article 16. Article 16 of this draft convention is on liability. And as Karen Parker has put it, this war crimes committed. And war crimes mean you also have to stand, they have to, you can be put, be liable for the crimes committed in terms of civil law. That's what we try to introduce here through international law, through an international principle. Maybe not all of you are aware of the fact just now, today, I think, in Bonn at the Landgericht, there starts a legal proceeding, a civil law proceeding against the federal government of Germany on the accusation, on the issue of this illegal NATO air campaign attack, the Wavering Bridge. And that's the first step. And it's really courageous lawyers and colleagues who did that, and also to get the money for starting proceedings. The first step, it may be a really historic step, that a government is accused of war, having committed war crimes in an alliance, and maybe had liable for this, to pay compensation of some hundreds of thousands of euros, but not the sum matters. It's just a fact that maybe in this case it will be decided that the state cannot claim immunity, that indeed individuals have the right to go on with these proceedings. And that's the really a tremendous step forward, and that's also related to Article 16 liability. So maybe for the time being that's enough to just send out the message, hi, we have a draft treaty, here's some text to discuss on this. Next step, look for partners, look for political settings to get lobby work going on, to just make headway. That's the main message I wanted to send to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.